just increasing the plastic for 2 weeks in a rat's water supply, those rats ended up developing symptoms similar to dementia. The PFAS, the BPAs, we have, you know, science, we have a direct connection.
Greetings, Earthlings, and welcome back to Earthlings 2.0, the show where we imagine how we could be better versions of ourselves and build a collective future we actually want to live in. Today, our guest is from the Earth Day organization. Yes, that same group that's been organizing a celebration and appreciation of our planet on April 22nd since 1970. This year, their theme is to put an end to plastics pollution. And we've covered plastics before in shows like Plastic Diet of Season 2 and how plastics could become carbon negative by using carbon emissions, as well as how to destroy PFAS, those forever chemicals. So we covered those in this season. So that's episodes 6 and 7, if you want to go listen to those. Today, we're going to dive deeper into actually how we deal with all this plastics pollution at a global scale and get some insider knowledge on the UN Plastics Treaty that's being developed. It's all coming your way. But first, I'm your host, Lisa Ann Pinkerton. I'm the CEO of the award-winning PR firm Technica Communications. We're celebrating our 15th anniversary this year. It's pretty cool. I'm also the founder of Women in Clean Tech and Sustainability. And before building those organizations, I was an award-winning environmental science reporter for NPR and PBS. Now, I bet you're thinking I'm about to ask you to leave a review. And normally I would. But I just got back from this podcast conference and I learned that reviews don't actually encourage the algorithm to suggest a show to a listener like you. In fact, podcasts writ large have a discoverability problem. Like, there's just no good mechanism for you to share a podcast with somebody else. There's no button you can push. There's no repost or something like that. That's something that the whole podcast industry is working on. And I also learned that our metrics are pretty good. You are all very loyal listeners and you show up every week and you listen to more than 70% of an episode. Really appreciate you. Thank you for being our listeners and being a part of the Earthlings 2.0 community. We want to know who you are and we want to communicate better with you. We are going to be doing a listener survey and we're going to create a Substack newsletter. Please take a moment to click on the links in our show notes and take the survey and subscribe to our newsletter when we put it out. Also, you can go to our website for that stuff too, earthlingspodcast.com. And if I could make one more request of you, the next time you're talking podcasts with your friends, would you please consider mentioning Earthlings 2.0? Sharing this podcast with your friends is the very best way that you can help us grow our community. And that can be just mentioning it, or you can go to the app when you're talking to them and you can find our show and you can share it and send it to their phone and then they'll have it. So thank you for doing that for us the next time you're talking podcasts. And thank you to Resource Labs for having us on the network.
Attention, climate innovators, tech startups, and industry pioneers. Are you tired of waiting around for people to notice the cool stuff that you're doing? Startups tap award-winning clean tech PR firms like Technica Communications because it's still the most cost-effective way to scale their sales and investment pipeline. Whether you need better ways to talk about what you do, access to new markets, or simply gearing up for your next fundraise, Technica has you covered. For more information, visit technica.inc or visit us on LinkedIn. And hey, tell us if the Earthlings 2.0 podcast sent you.
Hey, listeners. This show is a part of the Resource Labs Network. It's a curated collective of industry leaders who are accelerating the clean energy transition. If you want to find out more, visit us at resourcelabs.co.
Okay, story time. My first Earth Day was way back when I was a sophomore in high school, which is 1992. Yes, we all know I've been around for a while. Look at my gray hair. It wasn't always gray, but I just stopped dyeing it when COVID happened. Anyway, I was a theater kid, and we had some kind of rehearsal, and there was an Earth Day celebration in the park directly across the street from the Civic Theater in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And we went to the festival, and they had exhibits, and they had food and crafts, and there were some, you know, things that you could buy. I bought a poster that had a picture of the Earth on it, and I had that in my room for like the next 15 years. I loved that poster. It was just a picture of the Earth. It didn't say anything. It's just a picture of the Earth. Anyway, we're walking back to rehearsal after this festival, and one of my friends had some gum, and he's opening up the gum package, and he says to the rest of us, "Hey, anybody mind if I litter?" And this was a running kind of joke that we had in our group. Like, if nobody minded if you littered, then it was okay. And you were like absolved of the guilt of littering. And I stopped on the sidewalk, and like my friends bumped into me, and I looked at this guy, and I was like, "Yeah, actually, I do mind if you litter. We just left the Earth Day Festival. Like, did you learn nothing? Were you not paying attention?" And he's looking at me, and I can see the gears in his brain turning and connecting the joke that we had and what he was just about to do with everything that we had just experienced at the festival. And it was in that moment that I realized, wow, there is a massive disconnect between education and affecting a person's actions. And this was the seed that started me on my environmental clean tech career path. I didn't know it at the time. A lot of other things would have to happen. But this was like the start. This was like the kernel of a moment. If you think that taking a kid to Earth Day festivals or doing a cleanup or something like that, even if they're a teenager, isn't going to have an impact, I'm here to tell you that it will. It does. It can. So this year at Earth Day, I encourage you to take somebody else who wouldn't normally enjoy this holiday. And it is a holiday. It's a celebration. It's an appreciation. And take them outside into the world, do a nature hike, go do a cleanup, go to a festival, do something with someone who wouldn't normally do this on their own. And that's a great way to celebrate Earth Day. After hearing all of that, you can understand why when I was connected to the Earth Day organization this year, I knew I wanted to have them on the show. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, their initiative this year is to end plastics pollution. And the man behind this initiative is Aidan Sharon, and he's the director of the End Plastics Pollution Initiative at the Earth Day organization. And before leading that effort, he worked in wetland reclamation and taught middle and high school science. So he's a perfect type of person to lead an education campaign. He also studied biology and graphic information systems at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington.
As I grew up on the beach of North Carolina, where I saw the prevalence of plastic, especially in our marine ecosystem, which led me to working in wetland reclamation and then to teaching and finally to my position now at EarthDay.org.
And so could you give us an overview of the End Plastics Pollution Initiative that Earth Day is taking on?
Our mission is to highlight the health risks associated with microplastic and its added chemicals that the public is generally unaware of. So our mission is clear, to shine a spotlight on the dangers of plastic, both for our planet and individual health. What a lot of people don't realize is that plastic has become such a commonplace in our modern lives is actually pretty dangerous for us and pretty dangerous for the environment. I know we've all seen, you know, the turtle with a straw up its nose, and we've seen the seahorse holding a Q-tip. What a lot of people don't realize is that once plastic starts to break down, it's also entering into your bloodstream, you're crossing your blood-brain barrier, found in the placenta of pregnant women, and just causing a whole host of issues that I'm sure we'll dive into.
Yeah, it can feel pretty scary and daunting to dive into how ubiquitous plastic pollution, especially microplastics, have become. But we don't want to be, you know, burdened down by the anxiety of it. We want to think about solutions and how to overcome it, right? So I would love to hear from your vantage point, like, why is Earth Day making this its focus for Earth Day this year?
Our goal is the reduction of plastic and the reduction of plastic pollution within that. But the only way we see there to be a reduction of plastic pollution is a reduction in plastic production. So what we're calling for, specifically as EarthDay.org, is a 60% reduction in plastic production by 2040, which sounds like a super big number, sounds really daunting, but in reality, the majority of plastic, so 50% of plastic, is single use and not necessary. And the majority of that is packaging that we're using one time, and we're also using it to wrap our foods. And a lot of these foods don't need that packaging. So you can go to the grocery store now and find a orange wrapped in plastic. I had a conversation earlier today with a colleague from India saying he doesn't see that in India very often, but you know, when he went to the Philippines and to the US, he saw it as really prevalent. So it's just showing that it's an unnecessary thing that we have, and it's just something we've become used to, and that's why it's so prevalent.
Well, first off, if you're watching the video, Marco, my cat, has just joined the interview, so I apologize if that was a little weird for those of you watching. If you hear him in the background, that's what's happening. So you said a 60% reduction in plastics by 2030 is what you're calling for. And yet a lot of this reduction you're looking to make in the single-use plastics. How can we go about that reduction, having watched states like California ban single-use plastic bags, right? Yet they're still pretty prevalent around the state. Like we haven't gotten rid of them. There's all these loopholes that happen. What's your take on some of that stuff?
My take on that is it's going to take at start of kind of local legislation. So local legislation lately has been the most successful. I come from Dare County, North Carolina, where we had a plastic bag ban for a couple of years, and it looked really great. I went away to college, came back, and was like, why the hell are there plastic bags floating all over the place again? And my dad informed me that the Business Bureau decided to rescind the plastic bag ban because they said it was bad for business, when in reality, it's kind of driving property values to go lower. It's driving tourists away from the areas because they're seeing it as just a trashy beach. And then it's just making business worse for everyone. We're also incurring costs on our local waste systems. So them having to go out and clean up all that plastic isn't the corporation's problem in their eyes. It's the, you know, taxpayers' problem. So I think framing it to start as like, hey, this isn't an issue that's going to go away without some legislation. And also saying, hey, it's affecting your pocket money. It's affecting you directly. Like, if we start to phase out plastics, you're going to have more money in your pocket. Your government will have more money to spend elsewhere. And we don't have to look at the eyesore that is a plastic bag. Like, nobody wants to see that in a tree. Nobody wants to see that on a beach. So local legislation is where to start. And then moving up the line, we also need to call on our state legislations to, you know, first of all, get rid of preemptive bag bans, or preemptive plastic bans. So a lot of states have instituted, you know, preemptive laws to prevent there from being bag bans, which is like, why? And it's because of industry's influence over these states and allowing local communities to decide what's better for them. And I'm, you know, might sound like I'm a small government person with that statement, but in reality, it also is going to take going up from there to also implement federal legislation. So looking at, you know, reducing plastic production from a federal standpoint, and then also investing in solutions to the plastic problem, whether that's increased reusability or just looking at where the petrochemical industry is diverting their money away from, you know, currently, it's all invested in fuel, but as we move away from fossil fuel as our main fuel source and petroleum as our main fuel source, they're going to move to upping the plastic production So maybe we should start cutting subsidies to these placid people because, you know, in the end terms, they're not paying for the healthcare cost. So a recent study came out that $250 billion a year is spent on preventing diseases caused by plastic and plastic production in the U.S. alone. Globally, that's in the trillions of dollars. So, you know, getting rid of plastic is going to save us money. It's going to make the place look cleaner. And it's just overall a better idea than what we're currently doing.
What were some of those health conditions that the paper was connecting directly with plastic pollution or production?
So what we've noticed is a trend, and there's actually a place in the United States that kind of we see it the most. We've noticed a trend in cancer rates going upwards. So there's a part of Louisiana and part of the Gulf that is called Cancer Alley, where the majority of plastic is produced, but we're also seeing a super high amount of people with cancer compared to other areas. The other issue with that is it's disproportionately affecting, you know, Black and Brown communities, frontline communities, and, you know, people that just don't have as much wealth to move away from those areas. That's not including all the issues that come from, you know, in children. We're seeing rises in ADHD. We're seeing lowering of fertility rates in the next generation. We're also noticing that there's early onset puberty and a lot of children, which, you know, isn't great. And just all around endocrine disruption causing these things because of the chemicals that are added to plastic and then the breakdown of those plastics.
Counter argument might be, well, there's lots of different things that could be causing earlier puberty or more ADHD or autism or these types of things, right? So how do we know that it's plastics that are causing that and not other factors such as hormones in milk production or other types of, you know, I can see ADHD, you know, sometimes I feel like I have ADHD just because I look at my phone too much and everything I get from here is like 15 seconds of entertainment, right? So how do we know that it's plastics that are causing these issues?
I'm not a scientist. I just take what all these scientists tell me and I try to translate it to be, you know, more accessible to the majority of people. But people like Pete Myers, who's been studying endocrine disruption for the past 30 years and has just been saying, hey, the chemicals we're adding to plastic are doing this. The PFAS, the BPAs, we have, you know, science. We have a direct connection. We've tested it in rats. We've tested it in other animals. We're showing that these animals have an increase and mimic the same symptoms of ADHD or even dementia would be in humans. University of Rhode Island did a study last year where they saw that just increasing the plastic for 2 weeks in a rat's water supply, those rats ended up developing symptoms similar to dementia. So it's not just we're pulling it out of our ass and saying, hey, there's more plastic in the world. This must be the issue. This is the problem.
I saw a cartoon at one point, which had three waves. It had the COVID-19 wave, and then there was the climate change wave, and then there was the plastics pollution wave, which was even larger, right? So like, you think COVID's bad, wait till these other waves hit. And it can feel very daunting because plastics are so ubiquitous. So I'm happy to hear that we are working on a treaty globally to address this. You've been sitting in these meetings. What are you learning from the interactions that are happening in these meetings? You're not able to really talk specifically about certain things, but you can kind of talk generally about what you're experiencing here. Open the door for us. Help us to understand like what's happening here.
I mean this in the kindest terms possible. These meetings can be boring as hell. It's like I went in and I've never been a, you know, part of these types of negotiations before. I come from a town where my parents owned a restaurant. I worked in restaurants. I was a teacher. I worked in aquariums doing education. I did wetland reclamation and was like, okay, this is all pretty like cool environmental stuff. Like, what does the actual negotiations look like? And I jumped in there and was like, oh, we're literally arguing over a paragraph for 3 days or over the definition of a word for 3 days where one lawyer's definition of source is different than this lawyer's definition of source. And it's just like, Can we just move on? Can we get on with it? But the reality is we have to worry about what each definition is.
So what's been written up so far? I understand that we have some preliminary language. What does that say?
So as of, what is today, early April, we have what is called the zero draft. Well, we have the revised zero draft now. and essentially, that is going to be the basis of the next set of negotiations. So what that looks like is it's just a, I think it's up to an 80-page document laying out different options for different parts. So part of these negotiations are going to be talking about reducing the production. So there's different options countries can follow, or they can opt to add in another option. Or there's different options as to what a financial mechanism could look like down the line. But there's also language around, like, you know, A, we want to see complete transparency on the amount of chemicals, but no cuts in the chemicals. B, we want to see no cuts in chemicals, no transparency in chemicals. And C, why is this even in there? And then countries basically spend the day arguing about which option works best and then voting as a whole as to which one they're going to move forward with.
Thank you for walking us through some of that minutia. And I understand that it can be a bit dry, but for me, you know, we're basically operating under international anarchy, right? And so this is how international anarchy works. Very long, methodical meetings about treaties and getting to some middle ground that everybody can agree on. And the first version of that treaty, you know, might not be something everybody wanted, but it's a place to get started, right? What I'm curious about is, are there any games that certain countries are playing to sort of draw this out, similar to what a very wealthy person might do if they were getting sued? Just like flood the courts with all these motions and just like delay, delay, delay.
So that's actually one of the more exciting parts I noticed in these meetings is these country delegates are chosen for a reason. They're really good at their job. Certain oil producing countries, oil being, you know, plastic bean oil, send their best delegates that really know how to run out the time on these issues. So they will get 5 minutes to talk with an added 2 minutes or so. I'm just kind of making up these times. With an added 2 minutes if they go over. And they will run it to like 6 minutes, 59 seconds to, you know, kind of put it on hold. And then they'll get a rebuttal and then they can respond to the rebuttal. And then two oil producing countries can just go back and forth rebuttaling each other and kind of extending the timeline and pushing back the negotiations. And these negotiations have a set date and a set time. Like they can go until, you know, the wee hours of the morning, but at the end of the 10 days, all the countries have to pack up their stuff, go home, and wait for the next set of negotiations. There's not any official intercessionary work yet, so no official, like, hey, we're just sit down as two countries and talk about it, but I'm sure they're doing it. Like, we're not in an echo chamber.
Right. Behind the scenes, you think they're talking about things?
Oh, 100%. There's no way that, you know, countries like the United States are sitting there and just like, we're just not going to do anything until it comes up. We're not going to consult with our, you know, friends on the other side of the world that are also oil producing about what we see next. And then we'll also see a lot of countries bringing in kind of petrochemical representatives and petrochemical lobbyists into the room and using them as delegates and saying that, hey, these are representatives of the people of our country coming to talk about the issues. When in reality, they're just representing the, you know, largest corporations in the world. The multi-trillion dollar industry that is the petrochemical industry.
Yeah. Something about between INC 2 and INC 3, there was a 36% increase in the fossil fuel and chemical lobbyists that were part of the negotiations.
Yeah, we expect that number to go up.
Oh my gosh.
As well.
Oh my goodness. Member states like veto. Does anybody have veto power?
It's kind of a double-edged sword. So if we're going to invite, you know, civil society and have people there that are representing the entirety of humanity, the way this treaty is currently set up is that you can't kick out industry as well. Despite it being about them, and despite them being the ones that are, you know, the issue, they still have to have some representation according to this treaty. Other treaties, specifically WHO's tobacco treaty, so the World Health Organization's tobacco treaty, they recently declared that the tobacco industry cannot be present at the negotiations and kind of be stakeholders in the negotiations because it presents a conflict of interest. What we're hoping to see coming out of INC 4 and 5 is that same thing of being like, hey, this treaty is about you. You can't be in here kind of deciding what's going on. We don't want to see you investing all this money to be like, plastic is great. Or whispering in the ears of a delegation saying, hey, we'll build a plant in your country if you promise to vote for this option rather than another option.
On one hand, I can understand that like some of these folks are experts in their fields, right? And they have a lot of insights and expertise. Great. But you're right. It is a conflict of interest, but it is also something that's deciding the fate of these businesses. So I can understand how, like, on one hand, it's appropriate to have them a part of the conversation because what's going to be decided directly impacts their business. But on the other hand, if there's too many of those, if the weight of voices is too heavy on industry and not enough on the citizens or the earthlings that are being affected by this, then it becomes, everything becomes unbalanced.
Yeah, and that's kind of the bigger issue for me personally, is we have 8 billion people in this world that are directly affected by plastic pollution. If we start saying, hey, the industry needs equal representation, there's no way that equal representation is actually equal, because the plastic and petrochemical industry definitely does not represent 8 billion people. They may be affecting 8 billion people, they may be poisoning 8 billion people, but they are not 8 billion people. If you keep including industry in these conversations and keep saying that industry needs an equal say, you're basically saying industry is worth more than the earthlings, they're worth more than the people. Which, to me, as a member of civil society and working for the betterment of environmental health and human health, is ridiculous.
I was looking at your website, and can you tell us some case studies that Earth Day has been involved in around curbing plastic pollution?
Released a report back in November called Babies versus Plastic, which is kind of, we don't normally do that. We leave that to, most of the time, leave it to the higher level scientists, but we realized there was an issue around scientists really communicating with each other and formatting it in a way that's readable. Not a lot of people want to sit down and read article after article, scientific journal after scientific journal on the plastic issue. So what we basically did was wrote a meta-analysis of a lot of these papers and condense it down to a way that I understood it and a way that I would go to my dad every once in a while and be like, do you understand what I'm saying here? Like, is this understandable? Like, you're completely out of this environmental field. Like, you're smart, but this is not your focus. Like, do you get what I'm trying to say here? And he'd be like, yes. And then I'd pass it on to our editors to read it again. So Babies vs. Plastic was our first step into that meta-analysis realm. We're coming out with a report on climate education, kind of in the same vein, so focusing on climate education across the world. And then I helped write a report that's coming out soon called Pets versus Plastic, which is going to be just as dreary as Babies versus Plastic, but for your pets.
And probably, you'll probably get a greater response, frankly, from people who now learn that their pets are so affected by this. Like, you know, people might get more engaged. It's weird, but people really are willing to go to the ends of the earth for their pets, because not everybody has kids, right?
I have 2 dogs at home. I started writing the report and was like, oh, this is terrible. My wife's looking at me. She's like, you okay? I'm like, I wrote this whole babies one and was able to knock it out. Like, wasn't having any issues. I don't have any kids. This is fine. And then I got to the pets one. I'm like, oh, this is really... You're really cutting deep now. I just, as stupid as it sounds, that I should care equally, but it's like, I'm looking at 2 dogs.
All those pet parents out there, can you give us a sneak peek at what might be in that report? Because now I'm super curious. I'm a pet parent myself.
So it turns out there's not a lot of regulation within the pet food industry. And there's a lot of plastic being found in your pet food because of the lack of regulation. Some countries and some people do it better. The EU has slightly more regulations than the US, but overall, the biggest takeaway from that report was there's not a lot of rules around our pets' food, which is terrifying. I'm aware of that. So it's just also how little research has been done on relating plastics to our pets and kind of looking at the different ways that it can affect them. So we have tons of research on humans, tons of research on lab rats, tons of research on lab animals that have been tested with these things, but we haven't actually tested our pets. There's not a lot saying that we're seeing, or there's not a lot of research saying that plastic is affecting dogs, because no one's taken the time or invested the money into looking at it. So maybe we should invest some money there, or it's maybe just focusing on reducing plastic overall, and then we don't have to invest our money there because we can guarantee that it's not entering into our food streams, both for our pets and us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I barely have enough time to cook food for myself. Now thinking about having to cook, you know, cook homemade meals for my kitties, that can feel daunting. So what else could people possibly do? Should they be looking for something in the ingredients list? Should they be looking for a certain certification? What would be a tip for people out there?
So I guess the biggest tip I can give right now is kind of avoid those easily broken down plastic toys for right now. So a lot of toys are made up of plastic. A lot of people don't realize that, but those ropes that for your dog more specifically, I'm sure you have cat toys made up of nylon or artificial fibers, are actually plastic and they break down really easily. And besides, you know, them being entangled in the intestines of our animals, or you having to pull a string out of your dog's ass or something, like I've had to do on many occasions because the dog won't stop swallowing the toys whole and I really wish you would stop it. It's just avoiding toys like that. So maybe opt for more natural toys, you know, ones that A, aren't going to break down and shred up their stomach, like certain, you know, some antlers are not great for dogs, but maybe looking at, does it just sound gross? Beef trachea for your dogs, which is easily broken down by the dog. It's natural. Just looking for those natural fibers or those natural things that are just more digestible, frankly.
I was doing some research around, there's some initiatives that Earth Day and other organizations have put out around citizen data collection and using that data to then compel corporations to adjust their own practices. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on here? This is very interesting to me.
Yeah, and we're kind of just starting to get into this. We've had the Great Global Cleanup Initiative for, I believe, 5 years now. So that's kind of our volunteer cleanup initiative, or we work with different organizations to promote cleanups. And cleanups are fantastic. They're not the solution to the plastic problem, but they are a Band-Aid. But where some people have been successful is kind of marking down where or what type of plastic they're seeing the most, what corporation they're seeing it come from, Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola. And they're saying, hey, we're noticing that a lot of your bottles are washing up on the shores. And using that data, they're able to present it to lawyers or attorney generals, such as Letitia James, Attorney General of New York, I believe it was her, presented a case to PepsiCo, Frito-Lay, saying, look, these different organizations ran a brand audit and noticed that you had the highest amount of plastic, you had the most amount of trash being found on the shores. We are suing you for either the damages caused or the cleanup costs of this. And what we hope to see from these brand audits is litigation against these corporations so they kind of get their act together and start moving away from plastic and start moving towards either something that's truly biodegradable. And I say biodegradable, and I mean truly biodegradable, not just easily broken down in an industrial setting, which is the current definition of biodegradable, or moving to more reuse systems.
And this is that movement that we're starting to see with other organizations as well, like producer responsibility. And you see this, you know, with industrial sites, if you're allowing pollution to leave your facility into the environment, there is a clear connection between those two things. And so you are directly responsible for making sure you are not polluting the environment around the facility. And trying to take that concept to the streets, basically. Even there is this intermediary of the consumer. And so I think from the past, corporations have said, well, we didn't put that trash there, right? It was the consumer that did that. That's not our response. How could that be our responsibility, right? We didn't put it there. So because there's no direct correlation. So how do you argue this new perspective around plastics pollution and connecting it to the corporations and their responsibility?
The corporations pitch plastic because it's saving them a buck. It's saving them a lot of money on both packaging and reuse, but their profit margins that are at an all-time high. They can go back to reusability and still make billions upon billions of dollars from the consumers. What the consumers are basically just saying is, like, we're fed up having to clean up your crap. The government shouldn't have to clean up your crap. I shouldn't have to go out into my own backyard and find plastic bags that have been floating around. Like, enough is enough. You have solutions to these issues. You know, you had the technology. You used to do refill and reuse all the time. Like, it wasn't that long ago that we were using glass bottles, cleaning them out, and then shipping them back out. Like, the only reason you switched to plastic is because you thought you could make 5 cents instead of 3 cents. And it's just recognizing that the corporations have these solutions. They have the answer to these problems. They're just not willing to pay up for it. And the only way that's going to happen is if consumers start calling them out.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. And looking ahead, where do you see the future related to plastic pollution? Is it going to look anything like the past? What can we anticipate in the next few years related to this treaty and just plastics pollution writ large?
So the reason plastic has become such a, you know, big hot button issue is it's part of the triple planetary crisis. It touches every point of the triple planetary crisis, you know, climate change, air pollution, and biodiversity loss. And I think people are really starting to wake up to that idea, and people are really starting to realize, like, this is a problem. Like, we should not be using this material so ubiquitously that's breaking down and getting into our lungs, our water, our food. Like, we really need to start coming up with solutions or start looking even backwards for solutions. So I do think there is going to be a kind of a plastic revolution coming soon. We hope to kind of be on the front lines of that and help inspire people to become part of that. But I think there's going to be a call for, you know, producers to take on responsibility for what they've done to our planet. And there's going to be a call for governments to, you know, work for the people and call out these corporations. So I do see there being a reduction in plastic coming. I'm not usually that optimistic. I'm pretty cynical within my office. It comes from spending all day in meetings about how terrible everything is going on or reading articles about how terrible everything is going on. But I do see this, you know, global plastics treaty as being positive. And I think at the end of it, we are going to have some solutions and we're going to start seeing this problem not go away completely. We're never going to be able to get rid of plastic completely. But I do hope there's going to be more transparency, and I do see there being at least more transparency, less chemicals that are causing harm to people, and just less plastic all around.
Earthlings, you heard Aiden correctly. The United Nations is expected to deliver a legally binding agreement on plastics pollution by the end of 2024. And, you know, it might not be perfect, but it puts us on a path. So I'm very excited about that. We're going to keep close tabs on it. And once that draft is finalized, we will come back to you with what it entails and what the next steps are. I'm also really interested in these data collection initiatives that certain citizens groups are doing. So we're going to dig into that some more and perhaps bring you an additional story about what people are doing there. This week's Faith in Humanity is being restored posthumously by Senator Gaylord Nelson, or should I say post-Earthlingsly? Anyway, he was the driving force to create Earth Day back in 1970. And he wanted to use it as a way of forcing the issue of environment and conservation onto the national agenda in the United States. 20 million Americans showed up for Earth Day in different cities, and this included 2,000 colleges and universities, 10,000 high schools and grade schools, and several thousand communities. They all demonstrated that there was a significant grassroots movement to protect the environment and that politicians really should stop and take notice. And it worked. In December of 1970, the U.S. Congress authorized the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. That agency is not that old. 10 years later, 1980, we had the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the foundational act, the Clean Air Act, the Water Quality Improvement Act, the Water Pollution and Control Act amendments, the Resource Recovery Act, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, apparently those are two different things, the Toxic Substances Control Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, the Federal Environmental Pesticide Control Act, but wait, there's more, the Endangered Species Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, Federal Land Policy and Management Act, and the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act. Whew! Who says one person can't change the world? People singularly change it all the time when they take a stance of being a leader, like Senator Nelson did, and communicate a vision of the future that they want to see, and people agree with that vision when they hear it, and they want to help make it happen. When Senator Nelson was reflecting on Earth Day, he wrote, quote, "A significantly large and dispersed group of people recognized the fragility and finite nature of Earth's ecosystem, understood that everything is connected to everything else, and accepted the responsibility not only to set straight the mistakes of the past, but to avoid repeating them in the future. So long as the human species inhabits the Earth, proper management of its resources will be the most fundamental issue we face. Our very survival will depend on whether or not we are able to preserve, protect, and defend our environment. We are not free to decide about whether or not our environment matters. It does matter, apart from any political exigencies. We disregard the needs of our ecosystem at our own moral peril." That was the great lesson of Earth Day. It must never be forgotten. Thank you, Senator Nelson, and all of you Earthlings, for doing what you can to protect this beautiful blue-green space flower that we call home.